Sylvia Plath discovered a market for their papers. They used manuscript drafts as scrap paper to be used up and disposed of. It was only after Anna discovered that she could sell her husband's manuscripts to a London bookseller in the early 1960s that the couple began carefully saving such material. The Irish poet Derek Maughan similarly tossed his early manuscripts until the London dealer Rick Joukowsky got hold of a clutch of his papers and sold them to my university for a handsome sum. His surviving archive dates from that moment of recognition. But a self-consciousness of an archive's monetary value has led to a high survival rate for scores of paper-based archives. Uncertainty about the value of born digital content threatens the survival of today's contemporary archives. In the UK, the Group for Literary Archives and Manuscripts, GLAM, recently surveyed major research and university libraries, only to find that nearly half were unwilling to accept materials in electronic format. When the novelist Zadie Smith was asked what would likely become of her born digital archive, she replied, "I guess it will go the way of everything else I write on the computer, oblivion." The diskettes, CDs, and hard drives that are making their way into collections of personal papers are doing so largely through neglect. When I arrived at Rushden's London home, I found he had simply shoved his old obsolete computers into a closet. So the first question I would pose is, what will the survival rate be for computer files if there is no market incentive for such material to be preserved? Despite no clear financial incentive to save digital media, we do know that floppies and diskettes are making their way into boxes of personal papers and archives, sometimes in alarming numbers. Harvard recently found among the John Updike papers 5 1/4-inch program discs for Linus AmiPro word processing software circa 1992, indicating there must at one time have been 5 1/4-inch floppies, but none are present in the archive. What did survive, however, are 40 3.5-inch diskettes dating from a later period of Updike's writing life. It appears he would often use these to mail stories and reviews to his editors at the New Yorker and elsewhere. While Updike was meticulous about saving drafts that he had printed out and revised, he did not take the same attitude toward the digital files themselves and discarded used disks and overwrote other files as he revised. Similarly, the Norman Mailer archive at the Ransom Center contains, I'm told, 359 computer disks, 47 electronic files, 40 CDs, 6 main data loggers, and 3 laptop computers. Mailer would no doubt be delighted by his own digital prolixity, though it appears the bulk of this content was created by his assistant, Judith McNally, a detail that extends even further Jerome McGann's notion of corporate authorship. We will hear at this conference details about how some of our institutions are handling this digital content, but the second question I would pose is whether the steps that seem justified in the case of Salman Rushdie, John Updike, and Norman Mailer are scalable, whether the practices we employ in the cases of these celebrated authors are the right model for all born digital content arriving at our institutions. Harvard may well decide to take steps to preserve the 40 diskettes that came with Updike's papers, but will we apply those same practices to all digital content that arrives at our door? To cast the question in a slightly different way, what becomes of that professional practice of archival appraisal in the born digital environment? That is, the process of determining whether records have permanent value. SAA reminds us that appraisal may be carried out at the collection, creator, series, file, or item level. Do such practices developed in a simpler paper-based time apply to born digital content? According to professional practice, the basis of appraisal decisions may include a number of factors, including the record's provenance and content, the authenticity that Luciana mentions, the reliability, their order, their completeness, the condition, and cost to preserve them, and, may add, their intrinsic value. this one properly appraise electronic files that in many instances one may not even have seen? And a related question, how does one responsibly address the privacy concerns of living authors, short of asking them to reread the entire archive? Born digital appraisal may well shift how archivists undertake this kind of evaluation. Condition and cost may well rise in importance, as will entirely new criteria such as file types and availability of compatible software and hardware. Our modern literary archives have been built to support particular types of critical inquiry. During the post-war expansion of special collections in American libraries, major textual projects were launched with the aim of establishing authoritative text. Projects like the Mark Twain Papers Project at Berkeley, which continues to this day. With the emergence of electronic text centers in the 1990s, we returned to a kind of text-centered inquiry, granted with a significant difference, building and enhancing textual resources for online discovery. But the growth of collections of personal papers at many of our institutions also supported a wide range of other kinds of inquiry. The growth of new historicism in the latter half of the 20th century helped to expand the notion of textual objects altogether and encouraged use of our archives to examine the historical interconnections of writers and communities of writers, the business of literary production, the processes of canonization, and reading practices among different communities of readers in different places and times. Does the changed character of the Born Digital Archive merely represent these same objects of study in electronic forms, or do these forms themselves anticipate a corresponding shift in what researchers may now take as their object of study? Well, the researcher that sits down to rush to his computer in emulation mode be asking the same questions of the archive and examining the same forms or evidence of evidence? Or are we now promoting through our library's practices new and different forms of inquiry itself? A number of years ago, the Rosenbach Library acquired the entire contents of Marianne Moore's Greenwich Village apartment, including her velvet sofa. The aim, to the extent that it was ever expressed, seems to have been to evoke the absent author's presence through the objects she once touched, in this case, a velvet sofa that she once sat on. Is emulation, the desire to gaze at Rushdie's own desktop, prompted by a similar impulse? Is it prompted on some level by our own anxiety over the changing nature of the archive itself? Or are we trying to reassert the presence of the author at a time when he seems more fugitive and ephemeral than ever? Or, alternatively, has the new object of critical scrutiny emerged in archival-based literary studies? I have, of course, raised more questions than I've answered. In closing, let me simply add, on a personal note, that I resolved each one of these issues simply by moving from Emory to the Folger Shakespeare Library, a library where the central figure famously left behind no manuscripts whatsoever.